Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
That degree meant one thing for whites, another thing for blacks. I have still a 15-cent sticker on the frame that my law degree is in. It's tainted, so I just leave it in the basement.
Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas on 60 Minutes last night talking about his Yale law degree, as his new memoir has court watchers and book reviewers calling him an angry, embittered man. We will begin our 120 minutes for today talking with a leading Supreme Court watcher on this first day of their new term, always the first Monday in October, with at least one case of specific interest to New York and a new challenge taking shape just in the last few days to the way states administer the death penalty. Jeffrey Toobin is with us, the legal analyst for The New Yorker magazine and CNN. His own new book about the Supreme Court is called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. And Jeffrey, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Clarence Thomas first. Have you gotten a look at his book yet?
You know what? I have. They have held it under the most extraordinary secrecy. And,
except for Steve Croft. Except for Steve Croft. So you saw him on 60 Minutes, though, right?
I did.
What'd you think?
Well, the anger is the thing that is the most astonishing. I mean, here it is 16 years later after his confirmation hearings, and yet it is as if it all happened yesterday. And his resentment, not just of Anita Hill, but of what he sees as the media, political, law school complex that supports her and supported her, is really extraordinary.
So here's a clip of Justice Thomas on 60 Minutes last night in which he talks about the polarized confirmation process and its repercussions.
The process harmed her. It harmed me. And we see sort of the precedent for this kind of thing begin to even harm people like President Clinton. Things are out of control.
Things are out of control, and he linked that process to not only harming him, but harming Anita Hill, and I guess saying rolling all the way to the Monica Lewinsky situation in terms of how Congress dealt with that. What was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, I think I don't really buy it because, I mean, these are substantive accusations that were made against him. This was not something that people told Anita Hill to say, and frankly, I don't really see the connection with the Clinton, with the Lewinsky story. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, one of the stories I tell in my book is, you know, it's interesting to hear him talk about, oh, what a shame that President Clinton was subjected to this. But in 1999, Thomas appeared at the height of the Lewinsky matter at a so-called awards dinner for one of the most extreme right-wing groups that was nothing but a procession of Monica Lewinsky jokes. So he wasn't so disturbed about the Monica Lewinsky story in 1999 when the whole thing was happening.
But some people trace this back to the Bork hearings in the late 80s. Some people trace it back even further than that and say there's become this super polarized confirmation process, or in the case of Clinton Lewinsky, ongoing after the election, that is just more polarized and more personal, and trying to drag anybody down by any means necessary to accomplish policy goals. You think it historically holds up?
No, I don't think the analogies are appropriate at all. The Robert Bork hearings were about his substantive views. The reason Robert Bork was rejected for the Supreme Court is that his views on race and on abortion and on the right to privacy or the lack thereof were simply outside the political mainstream of the Senate at that point, and they voted him down because of that. That's why the confirmation process existed. I don't see any problem with that. I mean, the Thomas hearings were much more about his personal life, at least the second half of them, the Anita Hill portion.
Right. I guess it was looking at Bork's video rentals and things like that that have people calling it being Borked.
Oh, well, that video rental thing was of no consequence to the confirmation hearings. I mean, those were hearings about the substance of his views. And sure, there are people on the fringes of the political system who always do irresponsible things. But this is a extremely significant part of why the United States Senate exists.
And Thomas says that in his case, the Anita Hill story was not about whether he was a sexual assaulter. It really was a surrogate, a stand-in for his views on abortion.
Well, you know, I don't think that's entirely wrong. Certainly abortion remained the most polarizing issue. The irony there is that if you recall the Thomas confirmation hearings, he refused to answer about his views about abortion and, in fact, said to Senator Patrick Leahy in a famous or infamous answer that never in his life had he conducted a discussion of Roe v. Wade. And how many of us have, much less Supreme Court nominees, never discussed Roe v. Wade? So, yes, it may have been a proxy for his presumed views on abortion, but if you recall, in the confirmation hearings, he refused to say what those views were.
Jeffrey Toobin, my guest on WNYC, his own new book about the Supreme Court called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. I want to play the clip of Thomas from 60 Minutes that I think you referred to a minute ago. Here, the justice explains his differences with other people on policy and why he is so bitter toward people who don't share his approach to affirmative action and other law.
The problem with me and other people with our opinions is that we are veering away from the black gospel that we're supposed to adhere to.
So, Jeffrey, it's this sense that he has that other people on the left feel like they should be able to control him, especially because he's a black man, in terms of his positions on the court.
See, I think that's mostly a straw man. I don't think anyone questions his right to hold the beliefs that he does. The issue is the substance of those beliefs. You know, he has a very much a Frederick Douglass version of what racial relations should be right, which is basically that white people should leave black people alone, let them struggle to succeed on their own, and that any kind of effort to ameliorate problems with race, any effort to achieve diversity, winds up contributing to the diminishment of black people. It creates a crutch, it embarrasses them, it makes them feel like they haven't earned what they get. And, you know, that it's worthwhile having a debate over whether that's a good view. But I think this idea that people say he has no right to hold those views is preposterous. Of course he has the right to hold those views.
Why would he bring it up again? It was so ugly at the time. For those who don't remember, Anita Hill, a former employee of Thomas from a previous job, accusing him of sexual harassment, made public only during his confirmation hearings to be a Supreme Court justice. He said he was the victim of a high-tech lynching. The country was so divided, has largely filed the whole thing away over time, though, I think, people who were paying attention in 1991. Now he's revisiting it. Is it for the record, for the money? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a combination of those things, but I think the money is a big factor. Thomas is not a wealthy man. You know, he was still paying off his law school bills when he was appointed to the United States Supreme Court, and he got $1.5 million from HarperCollins for this book, which is a great deal more money than anyone else has ever received, any Supreme Court justice has received for a book. And so he had to deliver the goods. But, you know, I've watched Thomas's speeches around the country, and he gives many. I shouldn't say many, but he gives several every year. Usually at small Christian colleges and universities. As he said to one law professor I know, I don't do Ivies. He never appears in the Ivy League because he knows what kind of reaction he'll get. But in those speeches, he's always talking about how angry he was, that anger is a constant theme of these speeches. Now, he says he's overcome that anger, but I think the evidence on 60 Minutes last night and what I know of the book suggests that he's far from over it.
Did you get to interview Justice Thomas for your book?
I'm not saying which justices I spoke to and which ones I didn't. But I certainly spoke to lots of people around each of the justices, even if I didn't speak to each justice. And you know, one of the things that I think is neglected when we talk about Thomas is that, you know, this is not only the most conservative justice on the court, well to the right of Justice Scalia.
Really?
But the most conservative justice to have served since the 1930s. Clarence Thomas believes, as he's written in opinions, that much of the New Deal is unconstitutional. There hasn't been a justice who believed that since Franklin Roosevelt turned the court over in the 1930s and 40s. This is a completely different judicial philosophy from Justice Scalia, from any of the other conservatives, and that, to me, is the most interesting part of Thomas's record, rather than, you know, his frankly self-pitying views about criticism from the black community.
One other thing about Thomas, before we go on to some other first Monday in October Supreme Court stuff. You and other commentators are talking about his anger, but on the 60 Minutes segment, Steve Croft said Thomas is one of the most popular people in the Supreme Court workplace, including among his colleagues. Do you know if that's true?
That's totally true. In fact, I write that in my book. You know, one of the best-known facts about Thomas is that he never asked questions in oral argument.
Right.
But if you're actually in court, you see that he and Stephen Breyer are passing notes, they're telling each other jokes. I mean, he is a very popular person. That's what's extremely paradoxical about the guy, is that, you know, he knows the names of the cafeteria workers. His booming laugh is frequently heard. Just to give you an idea, you know, he's known as an ardent opponent of constitutional protection of gay rights. But once not too many years ago, he became friendly with one of Justice Stevens' law clerks, who was a lesbian, and he became friendly with the lesbian's partner, who was a professional snowboarder. And Thomas liked this woman so much that he put her picture up in his chambers for a while, the snowboarder. I mean, that's the kind of friendly guy he is. That is absolutely true that he's a popular person.
Jeffrey Toobin with us on this first day of the new Supreme Court session, and this New York case that's being heard today. A wealthy Viacom executive with a disabled child. Now, federal law guarantees the right to get reimbursed for a private education for disabled kids if the public schools cannot provide an appropriate public education. The New York City school system says they have a very well-regarded school for kids with this child's disability. The family never even tried that school, but contends that it would not have met his needs under the law. What's the legal issue that makes this case one for the United States Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court deals in cases in two areas. One is sort of constitutional law, which they always have the last word on. This is a case about statutory interpretation, the other things they do. What does the federal law about education, Title VII is known as, what does an equivalent education mean? How does that phrase get interpreted, and is it that does this wealthy executive's reading of the statute, meaning that the special ed program that the New York City Department of Education offered was simply not adequate. It's basically interpreting that law, and it's an important case because this comes up fairly often.
And some of the coverage that I've heard says it's about whether the parents can make a claim for private school reimbursement without having tried the child in the public school to see if it was okay. Is it that narrow?
Well, that's really what it's about. I mean, you know, we tend to concentrate in the press, and I'm certainly guilty of this, on the big constitutional cases, the Guantanamo cases, school integration cases. But a lot of what the Supreme Court does every year is interpret federal statutes. And the stakes are lower in those cases, because if Congress decides that the Supreme Court interpreted the statute wrong, they can always just pass a new statute or rewrite the statute. And that's what this case is about. It's important, but it doesn't have the magnitude of the constitutional cases.
Are there implications here for No Child Left Behind or for private school vouchers more broadly? I mean, some parents of regular ed kids in failing schools may say, my child deserves the same rights, that same guarantee of an appropriate education, as a disabled child.
Well, it's possible that there will be language in any opinion that points in that general direction. And, you know, one of the things we've seen, particularly in the last year of the Roberts Court, is that this is a very aggressive conservative majority. I mean, they are there to change the law. So it is true that this case is not really about vouchers, but certainly there is the possibility that the court, or depending on who writes the opinion and depending if who wins the case, you know, could plant some seeds that that are meant to
establish precedent
when in the issue of vouchers.
We have a minute left. I want to touch on this lethal injection case from California from Texas. For people who don't know, the court last week stayed in execution by lethal injection, and apparently they're looking into whether lethal injection, as typically administered, constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. So, Jeffrey, you know what people not steeped in this field are thinking. They're thinking this is supposed to be the humane way to put someone to death. No hanging, no firing squad, no electric chair, just a shot that puts you to sleep. What's the issue?
Well, the issue is at least one of the chemicals used in the so-called chemical cocktail has been banned for euthanasia of animals because it apparently causes so much suffering among animals. Anti-death penalty activists have seized on this and their own tests to suggest that even though it was intended to be a more humane form of execution, that it isn't. Frankly, I think this is an extreme long shot in the Supreme Court. I mean, for example, you have Clarence Thomas, who doesn't even believe that cruel and unusual punishment applies to the death penalty, and this is why the court is more conservative. Cases like this, they are going to construe the Eighth Amendment, the cruel and unusual provision, narrowly, and I think this is a case that they will take the opportunity to give the complete green light to lethal injections.
Jeffrey Toobin, legal analyst for The New Yorker and CNN. His brand new book is called The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Jeffrey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. One hallmark of the Bush administration as it comes to an end, the dead certainty of George W. Bush. We'll speak to an author of a book called Dead Certain about that and about Newt Gingrich's decision not to run but to criticize the Bush administration. Stay with us.